Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, crazy martinis for you as usual today. But, Jim, we would certainly be remiss if we didn't begin our conversation on the somber note that all Americans are probably thinking about this morning, and that's that once again there has been a horrific shooting at Fort Hood, Texas. We know 5 years ago nearly it was Nidal Hassan killing 13 people in what was clearly a jihadi attack. Right now they're saying that the three dead plus the shooter and the 16 wounded doesn't appear to be jihadi related. Perhaps it's post-traumatic stress. A lot of this will be sorted out in the days and weeks to come, but obviously once again a horrific event on one of America's great military installations, and doubly horrific that it's happening to the same community once again.
When you saw the headlines, the first word breaking yesterday, a disturbing number, like, was this a rerun? Is this some sort of error or something? And horrifically enough, it wasn't. And as you said, we'll know more in the days to come as they figure out what drove this shooter and why, and what precautions, if any, need to be taken in the future.
All right, on to the normal fare for today and the good martini. And of course, it was Victory Lap Tuesday over at the White House when they got their supposed 7.1 million signups. There's a lot of disagreement about whether that number is anywhere close to the number of actual newly insured people. But the good piece of news today actually comes from former Obama Press Secretary Robert Gibbs. He was speaking in Colorado, according to BenefitsPro.com, and he's basically saying that the Obamacare employer mandate will never go into effect. He says, quote, "I don't think the employer mandate will go into effect. It's a small part of the law. I think it will be one of the first things to go." And Jim, you and I have talked about how this keeps getting kicked down the road and kicked down the road and kicked down the road. And that might be the ultimate end game here. But to hear this coming from a former administration official who, albeit since he left the White House, has been known to be pretty openly critical at certain times of his former boss. But this one's pretty eye opening.
Yeah, two things kind of jump out about this. The first is that when somebody leaves government life and heads into the usually lucrative world of giving speeches to corporations and associations and things like that, usually you can count on a half an hour to an hour of absolute boring blather. If you're lucky, you get occasional old funny, you know, stories of the good old days or good times, something like that. And I say this as somebody who once in a while gets invited to do these sorts of association events and stuff like that. Robert Gibbs actually broke some news. He may have violated his contract. These are supposed to be boring speeches. And instead, he comes out and says, you know, a notably surprised audience. Now, one of the other things that kind of jumps out of it is you look at the quote that he says, look very carefully at his wording. "I don't think the employer mandate will go into effect. I think it will be one of the first things to go," he says. At no point does he say it'll be repealed. To kind of just underline in red the sheer lawlessness of how this gargantuan regulatory leviathan has been implemented. Say you're a member of Congress and you totally believe in the employer mandate. You pass that bill into law, and the administration is basically saying, nah, we don't feel like implementing that part. It's too hard. It's too complicated. Too much political blowback. So we're just not going to do that. And that's not the way the government's supposed to work. You know, at that point, you don't have checks and balances and stuff like that. So as much as there's a part of us who might like, oh, good, the employer mandate was a bad idea and it was going to hurt jobs and all that stuff, you're not supposed to just have the president say, nah, I'm not going to do that part. That's hard. You know, like, we have these laws written down for a reason. And it's not supposed to be arbitrary and up to, you know, the president deciding which parts he likes and which part, you know. It's funny, we spent all those years fighting for a line item veto, and now we have a effective presidency in which he basically just doesn't enforce laws that he doesn't want to enforce.
Kind of like the Office Space approach to policy. I just don't feel like going. So you're going to quit? No, I'm just not going to do it.
Or Bartleby the Scrivener, since I'm the high-minded cultural type who could, you know, drop those literary references and stuff like that. Yeah. You know, that law there, yeah, I would prefer not to. So, not going to happen.
All right, on to the bad martini now. And Jim, one of the reasons that Democrats really argue hard against photo ID for voters at the polls is because, you know, we just don't need it. There's no evidence that there's any sort of chicanery going on at the polls, the vote fraud of any kind. Well, National Review's own Andrew Johnson reporting just yesterday, quote, "North Carolina's Board of Elections found that tens of thousands of registered voters from the state have personal information matching that of registered voters in other states and appear to have voted in states other than North Carolina in 2012. In some cases, votes were cast under names of individuals who had passed away before Election Day. Here come the numbers. The review searched databases in 27 other states and 101 million voter records for information, such as matching names, dates of birth, and Social Security numbers. The review found that over 35,000 North Carolina voters from 2012 shared the first names, last names, and dates of birth with individuals who voted in other states. Another 765 Tar Heel state residents who voted in 2012 had the same names, birthdays, and final four digits of a Social Security number as voters elsewhere. Jim, we just had a presidential race not that long ago where 537 votes separated the winner and the loser in the state of Florida and decided the White House. 35,500 just in one state. Who knows how widespread this was?
I guess you could say, in a way, this is the good news in that this, you know, North Carolina has managed to do this fairly extensive review and found, you know, significant levels of this. The more problematic aspect is that why aren't the other 49 states doing this? Because if you think about it, all of these folks who voted twice, they're breaking North Carolina law, but they're also breaking the law of that other state that they voted in. When you look at, you know, the case of the 35,000, you know, maybe there are a lot of John Smiths out there or other names that are very common, Mary Jones or something like that. But when you get two, you know, maybe you could have the same date of birth, but that's getting, you know, you figure the odds of that are much, much less likely. Final four digits of a Social Security number, that's almost astronomical to have the same name, same birthday, and, you know, final four digits. So in that case, you got 765 in which we are almost absolutely totally certain that that's a case of voter fraud. This person has voted in two states. I remember the Daily News did a study of this about New York and Florida, because there are a lot of snowbirds, they call them. They own property in two states. And they found, I want to say, in similar numbers, at least a couple hundred, a significant number. And this was, you know, not too long after the 2000 election. And they called up some of these people and said, why did you vote in two states? Some of them got prosecuted, some of them didn't. But a bunch of them was like, well, the other side cheats, so I figured, you know, why shouldn't I?
Great.
Which was a really unnerving state, because if once you have that mentality, elections just turn into a question of which side can do voter fraud better. Basically, the collapse of democracy, the collapse of free and fair elections. But then the other aspect, which is kind of unnerving, is they said the 81 deceased North Carolinians, they said, look, some of them could be you submit an absentee ballot, then, you know, the next day you keel over or shortly thereafter. But they said there's between 40 and 50 who died at a time that that's not possible. I also seem to remember actor Roy Scheidner from Jaws, who apparently made a donation to the Barack Obama campaign 2 months after he died, which always seems odd. So, you know, like we see these things. We want everybody who's allowed to vote once. And we want to verify you are who you say you are, so that you're not voting multiple times or voting under somebody else's name or any stuff like that. This is not an unreasonable request. And, you know, every single time the left so passionately fights over this, a lot of suspicious minds would conclude that that party has become really dependent upon being able to stuff the ballot box in some of the, you know, least regulated, least policed, and least watch precincts in the races that matter most to them.
Be interesting to see how Democrats respond to this, Jim, but I think it might be even more interesting how Republicans respond to them. I can easily imagine Democrats saying, well, even if this is true, we don't have any idea how these people voted. And while Republicans might shoot back with, oh, we have a pretty good idea, what they should say is, it doesn't matter, it's a crime, and we should make sure that it doesn't happen.
You know, if somebody had said, you know, Republicans won a race and they won it on voter fraud, yay, good for us. No. If they investigated this, they prosecuted this, and they invalidated, let's say, 700 votes. And obviously, it's not going to make a big difference in the statewide races. But let's say some state legislator ends up, you know, the margin in that race was 700 votes or something like that. Toss his butt out of there. There should be consequences of this. So anyway, I'm just sighing and fuming and, you know, typically good evidence. And, you know, you realize what's really frustrating is that they do very little to dissuade liberals who insist, oh, there's no such thing as voter fraud.
Well, we're going to lighten the mood a little bit here in the Crazy Martini after all that frustration. And there was a fun skit last night on The Tonight Show. A lot of folks were worried that after Jay Leno and some of his zingers against the Obama administration went off the air, that Jimmy Fallon was going to be more of a tool of the Obama administration. He certainly fawned over Michelle Obama when she came on, but he's had some skits on that show that have certainly not been complimentary to the president. Yesterday, he actually had Sarah Palin on the program. We've got three clips here, the first one of which is rather extended. And just listen in the sequence of clips at some of the shots that he takes at the Obama administration, as well as the audience response to Sarah Palin.
Okay, talk to you later, Barack. No, you hang up. No, you hang up. No, you hang up! He hung up.
Hey, this is Sarah.
Hello, Miss Palin. It's me, Vladimir.
What are you doing calling me?
Well, I heard that back in 2008 you predicted that I would invade Ukraine. Is this true?
You betcha, Vlad.
You betcha, Vlad. I once invaded a country called You Betcha, Vlad. Interesting. You shoot bear? I prefer hand-to-hand combat.
Oh, yeah, we'll see. That's why everyone says you're such a strong leader.
Well, I come from strong genes. President Obama, he come from mom genes. Alaska really is close to Russia. Maybe I should invade.
I wouldn't if I were you, Vlad. You may be able to take down a bear, but you're no match for a mama grizzly.
So, Jim, they gave Palin some great lines there. They gave her credit for her prediction about Putin going into the Ukraine, and obviously shots at Obama with Putin kind of taking control of the conversation, and then the mom jeans line.
I was reminded of when Palin did an appearance on Saturday Night Live back in the 2008 campaign, where a lot of folks on the right were like, they're going to rip her, she's going to go there, they're going to make her the butt of the jokes. And they actually, you know, irony of ironies, Alec Baldwin was on that show, and part of the sketch was he starts talking to the real Sarah Palin, thinking that it's Tina Fey imitating Sarah Palin.
Right.
And then she says, I am Sarah Palin. And he says, you know, you're so much better looking than Tina Fey is. And it was kind of this, you know, that he made himself the butt of the joke, not her. In this one, most of the gags, you know, are Jimmy Fallon imitating Putin. And then there's a little bit of joking about Obama at the end. You know, it's a sight gag, so it doesn't work. But go watch it yourself. But Obama appears briefly, silently at one point. Another kind of, you know, shot at them. You want to talk about giving her a good line to end on. People in that New York audience who may not ordinarily be huge fans of Sarah Palin, but she's basically telling Putin, don't you dare invade my state. Don't you dare invade my country. You'd be messing with a mama grizzly. And of course, the audience goes nuts. Yeah, because you know, even a New York audience really doesn't like Greg.
What's that?
Russian invasions of U.S. soil. Red Dawn still plays well with this crowd. So I think a lot of conservatives are kind of, you know, surprised by this sketch. It kind of indicates that Fallon does not want to be only hitting one side. I think he definitely earned himself some points with some folks on the right for not just having Palin on, but letting her kind of, you know, get a lot of the good lines and things like that. So it's cute and funny. And kind of also for that millennial audience that may not be paying much attention to things, it reminds them, oh, by the way, Russia sent a whole bunch of troops into what was once part of Ukraine and is now, I guess, part of Russia, the Crimea, and there's, you know, occasional saber rattling indicating more invasions may come.
Jim, yeah. We've really covered the emotional gamut today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Friday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great day, everyone.